The English Eccentric by E.O. Higgins.
In 1765, a distinguished French scholar by the name of Pierre-Jean Grosley visited England for the first time and was struck by the level of eccentricity he observed in the natives. Writing home on the subject, he noted that this unusual behaviour he had observed could be attributed to a mixture of fogs, beef, and beer, aggravated by the tedium of the English Sunday. But what is eccentricity? Eccentricity is best summed up by the theme tune of the NBC comedy series Different Strokes, which of course says eloquently, "Well, the world don't move to the beat of just one drum. What might be right for you may not be right for some." It's powerful stuff. The eccentrics we'll meet in this podcast series are often people with corkscrew minds, peculiar obsessions, and largely incomprehensible outlooks. They straddle the sexes and all social classes. Some of their stories are famous, but most are unjustifiably obscure. But hopefully, what they all are is worth a listen.
William John Cavendish Scott Bentinck, 1800-1879. The Man with Tunnel Vision.
William John Cavendish Scott Bentinck, 5th Duke of Portland, was born in London, the second son of William Bentinck, and known by his middle name, John. In fact, all the males in the family were christened William, and thus it was customary for them to take their middle names, presumably because otherwise it would have made it difficult for their mum to call them each in for their tea. In 1824, following the death of his elder brother William Bentinck, known as Henry, Bentinck became the Marquis of Titchfield, and somewhat more unusually, also inherited his brother's position as the Tory Member of Parliament for King's Lynn, a seat they liked to keep in the family. Politics did not really interest Bentinck, however. He was cripplingly introverted, and when it turned out he couldn't really be a statesman remotely, he wanted out. To the utter chagrin of his father, he gave up his parliamentary seat 2 years later, citing improbable health issues. It was promptly taken over by his uncle William, known as William. At the same time, he took on a paid role as the captain of the Royal West India Rangers. However, since the regiment had ceased to exist in 1819, Bentinck did the honourable thing and only accepted half wages. The young Bentinck had a great fondness for opera, and this led to a short-lived infatuation with a Covent Garden singer named Adelaide Kemble, to whom he made his only marriage proposal. Kemble turned him down on the fairly reasonable grounds that she was already married. However, the rejection hit the young man hard, and he retreated to his bedroom, where he remained permanently for the next few years. Bentinck succeeded his father as the 5th Duke of Portland on the 27th of March, 1854, and consequently inherited his family's Welbeck Abbey estate in Nottinghamshire. Rocking up at his family seat, Bentinck immediately had a vast riding house constructed on the grounds, lit by 4,000 gas lamps. But despite having his 100 horses stabled nearby, he refused to ever enter the riding house and informed his stable workers that no horses were ever allowed to ride there. Evidently a creature of whim, one morning Bentinck awoke and decided to have a roller skating rink built on the grounds of the abbey, which he again never used and wouldn't allow anyone to go near. He also had the lakes on the abbey's grounds routinely drained and then refilled, for no obvious reason. Something of a maverick in terms of interior design, Bentinck then turned his attentions to Welbeck Abbey itself, immediately doing away with all the fixings and furniture, including heirlooms, antiques, ancient tapestries, and family portraits. In the new minimalist look abbey, he took to occupying a small suite of empty rooms in the West Wing. Bentinck's neglect of the rest of the building meant that the Abbey soon fell into a state of disrepair. By his late 60s, Bentinck's living quarters consisted of 5 uncarpeted rooms that he had painted bubblegum pink, but were which otherwise entirely empty, except for a growing collection of hair pieces and a single commode, which would also double as his chair. By this time, Bentinck had amassed a collection of more than 500 wigs and fake beards to use should any of his lordly duties force him to actually meet people. If he went out in the day, which was unusual, he preferred to do so in the comfort of a heavy disguise. In one of his 2 official photographs, his face is consumed by a vast black beard, and consequently, there is some dispute about it being a portrait of him at all. With his toilet seat and family seat both falling into ruin, an undaunted Bentinck concentrated his attention on building a complex of strange rooms and corridors beneath the abbey. This comprised of more than 15 miles of interconnecting tunnels, linking underground chambers with new above-ground buildings. It included a 1,000-yard tunnel between the house and the unused riding house. Another mile-long tunnel ran northeast from the coach house, which was also reputedly wide enough for 2 carriages to travel down side by side. It had domed skylights, readily visible from the surface, and by night it was illuminated by gaslight. The underground chambers, which were all painted pink, included a vast ballroom. At massive expense, the Duke even had a state-of-the-art hydraulic lift installed, so that he could carry as many as 20 guests into the room at the same time. Though, naturally, when it was built, he never organised dances, or indeed invited a single person to visit it. Though he employed many hundreds of craftsmen to work on his various baffling construction projects, and paid them handsomely for their services, it's often claimed that none were permitted to speak to him, or even acknowledge him. One poor worker that allegedly encountered Bentinck by accident, and instinctively raised his hat, was promptly dismissed. Yet despite being extremely withdrawn, Bentinck was remarkably well loved by the people around him. He gave each of his navvies a suit, a top hat, and a personal donkey. One of his housemaids even wrote a memoir about her time with him, in which she raved about his generosity and kindness, albeit from the other side of the door. Seen as a man with a rather compulsive personality, as well as something of a soft touch, one day the workmen on his estate downed tools and organised a strike, hoping for an increase in their wages. The Duke sent his valet out with a note to be read to the strikers. It read simply,
"You can strike as long as you like. It does not matter to me if the work is never done."
And after that, they quickly picked up their tools, and the building work resumed. Once his tunnel network was established, the Duke had his carpenters install a trapdoor in the floor of his bedroom, so that he could slip away underground without being noticed. He was often seen padding around his underground halls, looking over them with pride. But if any of the housemaids happened to be down there, turning on the lamps, as they did every night, they were required to turn and face the wall until he was out of sight. On the occasions when the Duke wanted to inspect his new designs, he would venture out at night, preceded by a servant carrying a lantern 40 yards ahead of him. To keep human interaction at a bare minimum, in his wing of the Abbey, Bentinck had double letterboxes built into the doors, one for incoming and another for outgoing mail. His tenants and workmen all received their instructions in writing. Only his valet was permitted to see him in person in his quarters. He wouldn't even let his doctor in. When Bentinck fell into a fever, his gentleman's personal gentleman took his pulse because his doctor was barred from entering his chamber and had to shout instructions from the hall outside. Finally, Bentinck ordered the construction of an underground rail system that linked all the buildings on his estate. The trains were elaborately decorated with velvet seats and heated rail cars, but in the end were only ever used to transport a roast chicken from the kitchen to a dumbwaiter installed below the Duke's bedroom once a day. The Duke's reclusiveness grew more pronounced as he got older, and this led to rumours that he was disfigured, mad, or prone to wild orgies. But contemporary descriptions suggested he was just a very normal, if rather timid-looking man, that just happened to have a penchant for vast, all-encompassing hair pieces. If the Duke had business in London, he would travel in the seclusion of his personal train carriage as far as Worksop, where it would then be loaded into a closed railway wagon. Upon arrival at his London residence, Harcourt House in Cavendish Square, all the household staff were ordered to keep out of sight as he scurried inside. The Duke died in his London residence on the 6th of December 1879, and he was quietly buried in a plot at Kensal Green Cemetery. His younger brother William had died without an heir a decade earlier, and so the title and estates of the Duke of Portland devolved upon the Duke's cousin, William. When William Cavendish Bentinck, the 6th Duke of Portland, arrived at his new estate, he was surprised to see that the beautiful natural lakes that spanned the grounds had been drained and cemented over. Going inside the abbey and clinging onto the front door, he found that the floor was missing from the main hall. Inside the west wing of the building, now the only habitable part of the abbey, he discovered that each of the rooms had been completely cleared of furniture, but had all been fitted with complicated locks. The pink paint that had been slathered on the walls was now peeling, and every room had been fitted out with a commode. What the new Duke initially took to be a pile of dead rats spilling out of a green box in the bedchamber, fortunately turned out to be the previous occupant's collection of false whiskers. The fifth Duke's reclusive lifestyle became problematic for his successor nearly 20 years after his death, when, in 1896, a new claimant came forward to the Portland estate, and the 6th Duke found himself embroiled in a peculiar legal case. A woman named Mrs. Anna Maria Druce, who ran a second-hand furniture shop in London's Baker Street, made the claim that her deceased father-in-law, Thomas Druce, was actually Bentinck, who, having tired of his seclusion and lordly duties, had reinvented himself as a simple tradesman to experience a normal life. According to Mrs. Druce, the Duke had a secret tunnel constructed from his London home in Cavendish Square to the back of the family shop, the Baker Street Bazaar, and he would appear there, sporadically, to flog cupboards to an unwitting public. Though unlikely, the story became the media sensation of its day, and got a new lease of life when Mrs. Druce's son George travelled from his home in Australia in order to claim the Portland estate. Though the whereabouts, or indeed existence, of the former Duke's tunnel could not be ascertained, the case dragged on for years, even after Mrs. Druce's admittance to an asylum in 1903. One of the main problems with the 6th Duke's legal case against the Druce family's claim was the lack of visual evidence relating to his predecessor, who had shunned photographs all his life. In 1907, the Highgate Cemetery grave of Thomas Druce was exhumed by authorities, and the coffin was discovered not to be empty, as had been the claim of the Druce family, but to contain the remains of a man's body. Witnesses were called to give further evidence about the former shop owner's appearance under oath, many of whom claimed that the late Mr. Druce had been famed locally for his bulbous nose and the large wart that occupied one side of it. Since the former Duke's known disguises were said to only involve hair pieces and not false noses or warts, the case was summarily thrown out of court.
This This is a special bonus episode requested by my English eccentric patron Claire Rowe.
She's so fine, she'll blow your mind.